From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Imagine a slave one day, a soldier the next. Today, we'll explore the journeys of Maryland's African-American Civil War soldiers. Adam Goodhart, author of 1861, and Harry Jones, curator of the African-American Civil War Museum, tell us about the veterans' wartime experience. Then, we'll learn about a project documenting the lives of the 7th Regiment of the U.S. Colored Troops, who trained in Druid Hill Park, mustered out at Federal Hill, and stuck around to settle Baltimore neighborhoods like Seton Hill. We'll also visit a community meeting to hear Seton Hill residents' reactions to the veteran stories. Plus, we'll get a sampling of modern honky-tonk with musician Artie Hill and chanteuse Mink Stoll. And Milton Kent, Sports at Large. Headlines first.
You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. I'm producer Lawrence Lanahan. Go to our website for more podcasts, audio archives, and lots more. You can also make a pledge to support rich local programming like Maryland Morning. That's WYPR.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. Now back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. As the Civil War played out, about 10% of the Union Army was of African descent. But blacks were prohibited from joining the Army until July 1862, 15 months into the war. In a few minutes, we'll discuss the lives of some veterans of the 7th Regiment of the U.S. Colored Troops. They trained at a camp in what is now Baltimore's Druid Hill Park and settled in nearby neighborhoods after the war. First, we're going to discuss the role of blacks in the Civil War military with Adam Goodhart, author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. He joins us from Washington College in Chestertown, where he heads the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Sheila.
And joining us by phone is Harry Jones, Assistant Director and Curator of the African American Civil War Freedom Foundation and Museum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Harry Jones, what was the usual way a black man joined the Army in the Civil War?
Well, most of our enlistees are volunteers. They're recruited in the regions of the country where they are mostly. Some of the northern regiments do a lot of national recruiting, but most were volunteers. Some, by 1864, you begin to see draftees coming in. And then you have substitutes where northern agents would go down into the South and get a runaway from North Carolina or Virginia to fill their state quota for the draft.
And these were free blacks or also slaves?
Most of the soldiers were enslaved when the war began. Now, you take a regiment like the 54th Massachusetts, those would be free men. But South Carolina regiments, Virginia regiments, Maryland regiments, you'd have almost 60% enslaved and 40% freemen.
Adam Goodhart, I was looking at a chapter in a book called Maryland Voices of the Civil War, edited by Charles Mitchell. He has a chapter about black soldiers. And there seemed to be a willingness by some slaveholders in Maryland who, though they were slaveholders, were loyal to the Union. They were willing to send their slaves to fight for the Union as long as they got paid for it.
It's an interesting part of the story that I think a lot of people don't know, and a sort of a strange part of the story, because we don't imagine our slaveholders setting their slaves free voluntarily. As you say, it was really the money that helped. This really began in early 1864. There was a program in the border states where slaveholders would receive a bounty of $100 if they manumitted a slave to join the Union Army. And this happened throughout Maryland. One reason it was so popular was not necessarily because these slaveholders were eager to free their slaves or have them go off and fight for the Union, but because by that point already Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation. People saw the writing on the wall. Slavery in Maryland would be abolished in late 1864, and many of these slave owners saw it as a chance to, as terrible as it is to phrase it this way, sell their slaves at fire sale prices before their value was completely gone.
And in Maryland, is it clear where most of the black volunteers came from?
I don't know if there's been a geographical breakdown done, but I do know that they came from across the state. There seem to have been particularly large concentrations in some of the counties of the Eastern Shore. I know that in Kent County, 400 African-American soldiers enlisted, a tremendously large group of soldiers. And in fact, there were soldiers from Kent County around Chestertown who fought not just in regiments that were primarily Marylanders, but also in regiments like the famous 54th Massachusetts, the so-called Glory Regiment. And in fact, after the Civil War, these men returned to many of their counties in Maryland, and many of them became leaders of the effort to lift up the newly freed slaves after emancipation during Reconstruction economically and politically.
And if I may add, in Maryland, in St. Mary's County, you have two soldiers in the 38th, which is actually a Virginia regiment, but they were from St. Mary's County, and James Harris and William Barnes earned and received the Congressional Medal of Honor for actions during the Civil War.
That's right. I think there were actually five African-American Marylanders in all.
Yes, one sailor and four soldiers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
This is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Harry Jones, Assistant Director and Curator, the African American Civil War Freedom Foundation and Museum, and Adam Goodhart, who runs the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College in Chestertown. We're talking about black soldiers during the Civil War. What are the prominent regiments that we should know about, the black soldier regiments that we should know about from the Civil War?
Well, ones that I would mention is the 1st and 2nd Louisiana Navy Guard, which become the 73rd and 74th United States Colored Troops, which were the first regiments mustered in. The 1st South Carolina Infantry of African Descent, later the 33rd United States Colored Troops. Out of Maryland, the 4th United States Colored Troops, organized in Baltimore. Then you got the 7th United States Colored Troops out of Baltimore, which also has the distinction of having the highest-ranking African-American officer in the Civil War, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Augusta was the surgeon for that that regiment, which distinguished itself in both the Department of the South in South Carolina and in the Virginia Theater in the campaign to capture Richmond and Appomattox Courthouse. They were there when Lee surrendered to Grant.
This had been an all-white army until Congress in July 1862 authorized blacks to serve in it. So what happened when blacks joined this army?
The African-American soldiers, when they come in, one of the most notable things about them is how well-performing they are. They perform extremely well. And that's something that just isn't touched on and dealt with a lot in the presentation of this history. Benjamin Butler would say of the Louisiana regiments when he saw them drill, quote, "better soldiers never shouldered a musket," close quote. And that begs to what kind of training did they have before they came into the army?
Well, yes,
and of course this.
Of
course, this wasn't just a military issue either. This became a very prominent political issue because throughout American history, or at least throughout the past several decades, the idea of arming slaves, of arming African Americans at all, was something that was extremely controversial. It was believed that all you needed to do was put a gun into the hands of an African American, and he or she might well go on a rampage against the whites. This, of course, had grown largely out of paranoia in the wake of the Nat Turner Rebellion in 1831 and other slave uprisings earlier in the century. And then, of course, also it was fueled by the John Brown raid of 1859. And so the idea of arming newly freed slaves and free blacks was something that terrified many white people. At the same time, it was something that of course exhilarated African Americans, because this was a sign not just of trust, not just of military participation, but in a sense of becoming fully recognized and fully participatory as Americans. And in fact, one of my favorite quotes from the Civil War comes from probably the greatest Marylander who ever lived, and one of the greatest Americans who ever lived, Frederick Douglass, who was very involved in lobbying for African-American troops before they were actually enlisted, and then very involved in recruiting troops once they were permitted. And Frederick Douglass said, "Once let the black man get upon his person the brass letters U.S., let him get an eagle on his button and a musket on his shoulder and bullets in his pocket. There is no power on earth that can deny he has earned the right to citizenship."
Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for having me as well.
Harry Jones is Assistant Director and Curator of the African American Civil War Freedom Foundation and Museum. Adam Goodhart heads the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College. And we thank Mark Brown for engineering the line at Washington College in Chestertown. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In September 1863, the 7th Regiment of the U.S. Colored Troops was mustered into service at Camp Birney in what is now Druid Hill Park in Baltimore. In charge of the regiment was Colonel William Birney, the son of an abolitionist. Among the 7th Regiment were former slaves who gained freedom in exchange for enlisting, including 16 whom Birney freed from a slave pen on Pratt Street. Those members of the 7th Regiment of the U.S. Colored Troops who survived the Civil War were mustered out at Fort Federal Hill in Baltimore on November 15, 1866. Many of them stayed in Baltimore, settling not too far from Druid Hill Park, the spot where they had mustered in 3 years earlier. To tell us more about them, David Armenti joins us in the studio. David is a research archivist with the Maryland State Archives' Legacy of Slavery in Maryland project. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila.
Who were these men in the 7th Regiment?
So for the most part, we're talking about former slaves from the eastern shore of Maryland, but as well we see a lot of slaves from the big plantation areas of southern Maryland as well, and even some free blacks mixed in.
I was going to say, when you say former slaves, were they former at the point they became soldiers?
In large part, we're talking about men who were manumitted or freed from slavery by their owners specifically so they could enlist.
Tell us about that. How did that work?
It's actually a little complicated of a process because, as you can imagine, these slave owners weren't too happy about a federal colonel or another military figure coming in and trying to recruit their slaves when, in fact, many of these slave owners were Southern sympathizers.
Right.
So Birney and his associates would actually go into these communities, and there were some violent confrontations, but a large amount of the enlistment did take place in Baltimore. That was kind of a way to kind of a middle ground where the slave owners felt a little more comfortable if they weren't coming into their community to try and pull their slaves away from the plantation.
So did the Union Army basically buy the freedom of these men, or did they just take the men?
Essentially, you could say that they did buy the freedom. It was a $100 bounty that would go to the slave owner, and many of these slave owners saw the writing on the wall that the institution was winding down. You know, they wanted to get what they could out of it.
And so what was the price?
The $100 bounty that would come from the federal government went, in a white soldier's case, that would go to the soldier themselves. But since these men were technically owned, the $100 would then go to the slave owner. And we have all of that documented in the bounty rolls at the Maryland State Archives.
So slaves from the Eastern Shore, did they go straight from slavery to training at Camp Birney and then straight off to war?
Many of these slaves from the Eastern Shore were mustered in, did some amount of training, or were enlisted in Baltimore at Camp Birney, and then most of them were sent down to another camp in Charles County called Camp Stanton. They spent the winter of 1863-1864 there, and then the 7th was sent down and actually saw action in Florida and then in Virginia shortly after that.
That's David Armenti of the Maryland State Archives here on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about U.S. Colored Troops, 7th Regiment, during the Civil War. So they're mustered out in Baltimore.
Right.
November 1866. And then what for most of them?
A few of them we see actually going back to their home counties, get your wife, get your family. But some of them straight away went back to the neighborhoods and the areas of the city that they were familiar with. We see really about three pockets, or what I kind of look at as colonies within the city, which would be South Baltimore, actually very near Federal Hill, East Baltimore, just east of downtown, and then the northwestern, what was then the northwestern part of the city near Druid Hill Park, but actually below North Avenue at that point. And that was really the northern reaches of the city during the 1860s.
What did it look like then, that area?
Well, the area that they were moving into would look somewhat similar to what the older parts of West Baltimore look like today. Row houses, but the neighborhoods that we see a concentration of these men are the areas that in the 20th century really came under urban redevelopment. So the areas right around University of Maryland right now, but just north of that was somewhat rural, and which is why Druid Hill Park was established there in the first place, because it was a retreat for the wealthy of the city. But at that point, they saw an opportunity to use it for the war effort.
So what happened to these veterans after the war?
Unfortunately, what we see is that a lot of them were disabled. A lot of them were relying on these federal pensions to survive, essentially. And again, in the depositions, we see that this was not a scam in most cases. There was an impression, especially at that time, that these men, even the white soldiers, were taking advantage of the system. But from the depositions, we see that there were people that would attest that, yes, this man worked for me for 10 years, and he complained about rheumatism. He complained about what had been a gunshot wound. Many of these men ended up being reliant on that pension to survive. But there were some other interesting cases.
Like what?
Well, there was a William Hales who was in the 7th Regiment. He was a native of Kent County, a former slave. He'd been shot in the leg in an engagement in Virginia. But what's really interesting is while he was in the regiment, he had been detailed as a musician. In his later life in Baltimore, we see him in one of the census records as a teacher of vocal music. And this was a man that did reside in that part of the city near Druid Hill Park. He lived on what was then Tyson Street. It's very interesting to see how he took that experience as a troop and really translated it to a career for some period of time.
So do we still see in Baltimore today the residuals of this migration, this shift that included enlisting black soldiers?
I believe that we do. As a part of our research, we've used Google Earth as a way of really trying to contextualize this migration. We've plotted the addresses that we found in the depositions. And again, we've seen a strong trend in how these pockets of African-American migration developed. Near East Baltimore and near West Baltimore are the areas that became predominantly African-American as we move into the 20th century. I'd like to think that these were some of the pioneers in moving into these neighborhoods, which had either been mostly white or integrated in the 19th century sense of the word. So yes, I do think that we see the residual of these original populations coming in and that they were people who could pay their way into these neighborhoods and really establish, again, kind of a new community there within what was already established.
Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Sheila.
David Armenti is a research archivist with the Maryland State Archives Legacy of Slavery in Maryland project. At our website, we link to some of the materials David Armenti and the Maryland State Archives staff put together about these African-American Civil War veterans, including some short biographies and primary sources like pension files. The files include a deposition given in 1898 by a black Civil War veteran named Vincent Demby as he filed a pension claim. The deposition begins, quote, "I am about 55 years of age. Reside 633 Sarah Ann Street, occupation laborer. I was born in Queen Anne's County, Maryland, near Queenstown. I was slave born. I lived there to the time I went into the Army." Back in December, Maryland Morning production volunteer Brenda Wilson went to a community association meeting in Baltimore's Seton Hill neighborhood, where several of the U.S. Colored Troops 7th Regiment settled. She took Vincent Demby's deposition and some of the veterans' biographies, as well as audio of the interview you just heard. Then she gathered reactions from the residents. Brian Dunn is on the Seton Hill Association board.
Really excited, actually. It's a whole new piece of history that our community can celebrate. And I've been a board member for about 7 years, and we always use our history as part of our platform of what we tell people is so great about our neighborhood. And to have a whole new chapter revealed is pretty exciting.
Seton Hill was settled in the late 18th century by French priests fleeing the Revolution, and more French-speaking refugees came about two decades later from Haiti. Dawn McCleary Evans has lived in Seton Hill for 20 years.
I'm just excited because I knew about the Haitian refugees, but I didn't know about the Civil War soldiers, the African-American soldiers. So I'm excited. I'm going to do some research, and that'll help us as we continue to have our festivals and try to educate people about the history of Seton Hill. Seton Hill's always been a mixed community. It's never been all black or all white. It's always been a very mixed community. From people who lived here, who died, they said Seton Hill's never been one race. It was always mixed. And from a little bit I could research, Seton Hill was always mixed from the 1830s or 40s on up.
Kevin Henderson also lives in Seton Hill.
You know, I worked in Cherry Hill for Head Start, and I researched about Cherry Hill, and they had African Americans in Cherry Hill. That was originally the segregated area where soldiers could stay. And to find out that soldiers were here also was fascinating.
Production volunteer Brenda Wilson interviewed those Seton Hill residents in December. Information about Seton Hill, as well as the Maryland State Archives Google Earth file, and more on the 7th Regiment of the U.S. Colored Troops, all at our website, wypr.org. Click on Maryland Morning. Also there is information about a Maryland State Archives exhibit called Flee, Stories of Flight from Maryland in Black and White. It's up at the Maryland Historical Society in Baltimore. I'm Sheila Cast. Coming up, Baltimore country musician Artie Hill. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Stephanie Hughes. You've tuned in to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link.
Moon River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style. Someday, old dream maker, you heartbreaker.
Morning, everybody. Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 881. I'm Tom Hall. Moon River, the iconic song from Breakfast at Tiffany's, is one of more than 1,100 songs with lyrics by the great Johnny Mercer. His collaborations with composers like Henry Mancini and Hoagy Carmichael resulted in dozens of hits, many of which hold a cherished place in the American songbook. Artie Hill, known in these parts and beyond as a master in the art of honky-tonk and country music, has organized a tribute to Johnny Mercer. On Friday night at the Creative Alliance, Mink Stoll and Felicia Carter will sing some of Mercer's classics in a program called Artie Hill Presents Blues in the Night. For a preview, Artie Hill joins me in the studio along with Mink Stoll and the guitarist Michael Rachick. Good morning to you all. Good to have you here.
Good morning.
Tom. Morning.
So, Artie, you're a country guy. You're a honky-tonk guy. What's your connection to Johnny Mercer, who we don't associate with either of those two art forms?
Well, I guess this has sort of come to fruition because I've done a couple other shows with Mink. And the last one we did, I did a couple tunes from the Great American Songbook, including some Mercer. There's a real close relationship in writing styles between what we consider the classic American songs, Cole Porter, Gershwin, Mercer, and country music. Every syllable counts. Every word counts. People that write in both those styles have to be very careful. It's almost like haiku. There can't be any extraneous anything. And there's also a lot of long notes, which in rock and a lot of other styles, you don't write lyrically for really fewer words for long notes. And that's something that in country you have. And it's also something that it really is in common between, say, Hank Williams and Tony Bennett, you know, doing Cold, Cold Heart. You hear that song works both ways. That's an example of the similarity in writing style.
That's interesting. So it's got more connection to country music than pop music, you know, contemporary pop music, you think?
The writing style, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the economy of language.
Yeah.
You have to be able to be economic in both styles.
What do you think about Mercer in particular that makes his lyrics so incredible?
Well, you read a lot that people say that he was sort of folksy and had a country element to him, I guess because he was from Georgia. People think of him that way. What I think is really important about his writing is that it's very accessible, and it treats the listener as an equal with the writer. And if you listen to Porter and Gershwin tunes, sometimes you get that feeling that they're writing to a more elegant audience. Not always, but sometimes. Or that in order to be the person in the song, you might have to be a lot fancier person than you actually are. Mercer is purely writing about human emotions that any person who's listening can relate to. They can go to that place immediately.
And Mick Stoll, words mean a lot in your line of work.
Words mean a great deal, yes.
You're an actor. You've been in a lot of John Waters movies, a lot of other projects. As a singer, how do these words resonate with you?
Well, I've always been a sort of narrative singer since I started singing. I like to tell a story with the songs. And with Mercer, it's a story. It's a very simple story. He tells it. And that's how I like to work.
Well, you and Michael are here. Why don't we ask you to sing a tune for us? What do you want to sing?
Well, let's do P.S. I Love You.
Here's Mick Stoll and Michael Reichick here in our studios on Maryland Morning.
What is there to write? What is there to say? Same things happen every day. Not a thing to write. Not a thing to say. So I take my pen in hand and start the same old way. Dear, I thought I'd drop a line. The weather's cool, the folks are fine. I'm in bed each night at 9. P.S. I love you. Yesterday we had some rain, but all in all, I can't complain. Was it dusty on the train? Yes, I love you. Ride to the Browns just as soon as you're able. They came around to call, and I burned a hole in the dining room table. And let me see, I guess that's all. Nothing else for me to say. And so I'll close. But by the way, everybody is thinking of you. P.S. I love you.
Michael Reitzik on guitar, Mick Stoll, the vocalist in the great Johnny Mercer tune, P.S. I Love You. Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Really appreciate it. So, Artie, Mercer was also a popular figure in his day, not just as a composer. He's one of the founders of Capitol Records.
Capitol Records.
He performed. He was on the radio and stuff. So there really are a lot of things about Mercer in particular that distinguish him from some of the other folks that we associate with the American Songbook.
In the music business and the entertainment business, he was kind of a Renaissance man. He had such a feel for how to do everything. He was a really good singer. And the other thing that's interesting to me about the way he sang and the way he wrote is that he understood the rhythm of of blues in a way, and I know I'm bringing Hank up again, but I've said this about Hank a million times. He understood blues music. Mercer, I think I read a quote the other day that UB Blake said Mercer was the best white rhythm and blues or blues type singer he had ever heard. He made it sound so easy when he sang these songs, especially the ones that he wrote. There were very few people in the genre at that time, especially white performers, who had a handle on jazz the way that he did, and it certainly comes through in the writing.
Yeah, it's a pretty high compliment, pretty high praise from a pretty high source.
Absolutely.
Artie Hill, Mink Stoll, and Michael Reitzik. Blues in the Night, a tribute to Johnny Mercer, starts at 8 o'clock Friday night at the Creative Alliance at the Patterson in East Baltimore. Mink Stoll and Felicia Carter are the featured vocalists. The band is a good one, along with the guitarist Michael Reitzik. Alan Blackman will play piano, Ed Huff will man the drums, and Amy Shook will be featured on bass. We've got all the information you need at WIPR.org. Just click on the Maryland Morning link. So, Mink and Michael, we're going to ask you to take us out with a tune. This is Accentuate the Positive, and we look forward to Friday night. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Gather round me, everybody. Gather round me while I preach some. I feel a sermon coming on me. The topic will be sin, 'cause that's what I'm again. If you wanna hear my story, settle back and just sit tight while I start reviewing the attitude of doing right. You've got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, and don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You gotta spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum, have faith, or pandemonium is liable to walk upon the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah and the whale, Noah and the ark, what did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said, we gotta accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, and don't mess with Mr. In-Between. My last remark, Jonah and the whale, Noah and the ark, what did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said, you gotta accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, and don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
Mink Stoll and Michael Reitzik here in our studio. They'll be at the Creative Alliance, 8 o'clock Friday night. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. The program is produced by Lawrence Lanahan, Stephanie Hughes, Matt Purdy, and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers and occasionally makes muffins, although not occasionally enough. We have production help from Lee Utterback and Brandon Green. Coffee provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville on the web at zekescoffee.com. Our theme was composed by Chris Kennedy at Clean Cuts. The theme you hear Wednesdays for the Culture Calendar, that was composed by Austin Coughlin at Clean Cuts. Post Topography designed our webpage. We hope you'll come visit us there, WIPR.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. You can leave a comment about something you've heard or make a suggestion about an interview you think you should hear on our show. Also, check out the new interactive maps at the site for our weekly series on inequality in the Baltimore region. Go to linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Tomorrow, a conversation with Manil Suri about his acclaimed new novel, The City of Devi. We look forward to having you with us tomorrow morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, thanks for hanging with us. On behalf of the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.